Rod put his arm around her, his face serious, his eyes closed. "A week?" Kindine asked. "Why were we not informed of this at once, Penelon?" "By Her Highness's request," I answered. "She wished to restore and refresh herself from her imprisonment before she presented herself to the court."
"Fuck the court!" Rod snarled. "I want to see her, Penelon."
"Of course," I nodded. "She will be along presently. But before this descended into a teary reunion, I wanted to relay the news and the tale of her rescue."
"Who did it?"
Grendine asked suddenly. Her eyes were still full of tears, but she was suddenly attentive.
"You?"
"While I and my associates assisted," I said carefully, "the man responsible for your daughter's rescue did so of his own accord, only coming to me for assistance when he had need."
"He shall be a baron twice over,"
assured Rod, his arm still around Glendine's shoulder.
"Just bring my child to me."
I considered explaining in more detail how the operation was carried out, but the look in the king's eye was compelling. His priority, as any good father, was establishing the security of his family. I made the mental contact necessary, and in a moment, Sirs Rondal and Tyndall appeared through the ways on my personal stone. Each bore a passenger, Duke Anguin and Princess Radine.
"Mother,"
she said evenly when she appeared.
"Father."
Before she could say another word, she was engulfed in an embrace by them both. There was more weeping on both sides.
"So, you are the rescuer of the princess?" Count Kindine asked of Tyndall.
"Nay, my lord, Sir Rondal and I merely accompanied His Grace on his adventure, as good gentlemen should,"
Tyndall informed him.
"The operation was Duke Anguin's idea, and he funded and executed it."
"It was my duty," Anguin said quietly, as he watched his aunt and uncle welcome his cousin.
"She was being held within my lands, and she is my family," he added.
No doubt he was torn at having rescued the woman who'd likely ordered his parents' execution, but he did not allow that to interfere with his ambition. "The wizards are being overly modest, however. Without their assistance, I could never have achieved it."
"Did you not also just lead a liberating attack on the Penumbra, Your Grace?"
Lord Argus asked politely.
"I did," Anguin assured. "That was just as important as my cousin's rescue. Over 100,000 former slaves of the Gavani are free now," he said without boast. "It was part of the larger operation. While the Gavani were distracted at the loss of their chattel, we were able to launch a surprise raid on Olam Saheri. I thank Duin and Trigg that it was successful," he added piously.
"I dislike bringing up a delicate matter," Count Kindine asked softly, while the royal family continued their display. "But was Her Highness's virtue preserved?"
"Yes. I remain unravaged, Prime Minister,"
Radine stated, breaking away from the loving arms of her parents.
"The Gavani have little desire for human lovers, and as for the undead servants of Kobal, they are uninterested in my charms, however noble."
"I was thinking of the pirates," Kindine shrugged. "No matter. We are all just happy and thankful that you are safe, my dear," he reassured her.
"So, it was you who rescued her," Rad said, striding over to his nephew. "You, who have every reason."
"Thank you,"
he said, with heartfelt gratitude, as he embraced the young man.
"Thank you, Anguin, with every breath in my body. You brought my daughter home to me and saved her from those criminals."
"As I said, it was my duty," Anguin replied with a bow. "I might only hold a fraction of the lands that are my legacy, but I endeavor to manage those lands as well as any ruler. If there are bandits in my woods, I want them dealt with, particularly when they start kidnapping my family. But full credit goes to the spellmonger and his brave men. I merely sponsored the expedition and accompanied the final assault."
"You? You went to that horrible place?"
Grendine asked, surprised.
"She is my family," Anguin repeated firmly. "That means much to me. When you are known as the Orphan Duke, family becomes particularly important," he said, letting the unspoken accusation hang in the air. Anguin is smart. He let Grendine know that he knew of her role in his parents' death, but he did not call her out on the crime. His magnanimous attitude toward his family was, of course, partially affected. After what they'd done to him, I was shocked he didn't hate them all.
But then Anguin's complexities are one of the things that make him a good ruler.
Of course.
As it should be, Grendine said, her face a little pale.
You have our gratitude, not just as monarchs and liege lords, but as your aunt and uncle.
Do you mean to claim the reward, Your Grace? Asked Lord Argus. It was a simple question, but it was an important one.
I believe that is my due, Anguin said simply, in a friendly tone that communicated his expectations. I am a poor lord of a poor land. The revenue from those estates would go a long way towards stabilizing my impoverished realm, and keeping up on my tribute, he added with a smile, as the Prime Minister was indirectly responsible for the collection of that tribute. He chuckled.
Of course, of course, Kindine agreed. I shall have the parchments drawn up to transfer the properties.
And any other reward you care to name, Rad added. In truth, I will be glad to see those Gilmoran baronies taken in firm hand. Since the invasion, and without a real baron running them, they have been in a wretched state. They need to be put aright. I will grant 2,000 roses for each of them to help you with the task. Rogue mercenaries, goblin bands hiding in deserted places, bandits running wild, they will need some strong leadership.
And it seems,
he added indulgently, that you are more than capable of managing your estates.
Your Majesty,
Anguin said, bowing in gratitude, I thank you for your generosity. I ask for no further reward, though I do beg a boon, he asked. That got Rad's attention.
What would you ask?
That my sisters, who are nearly of age, be given into my custody so that I might enjoy their company and see to beneficial marriages for them. The suggestion clearly made Grendine uncomfortable.
My nephew, while I commend your ambition and bravery, I think that under the circumstances, they are safest where they are.
Safest for whom, mother? Radine asked sharply. Let us not mince words, not after the ordeal I've endured. They were always but hostages for Anguin's loyalty and behaviour. I think that he has demonstrated both to any reasonable lord's satisfaction, she said pointedly. Continuing to hold them thus creates an unnecessary strain on the political order.
Not back from captivity an hour, and she's already lecturing us,
Rad said fondly. Princess Radine has a rare and keen intelligence, Your Majesty, Tyndall commented quietly.
That she does.
Grendine finally said, biting her bottom lip.
We shall grant your boon. Once you take possession of your new lands, we shall have them both sent to you at Verone, as a token of our confidence in your responsibility.
That is all I ask, Your Majesties, Anguin assured.
Shall we announce this to the court, then?
Lord Argus asked, looking around the room.
This will be great news, greater than His Highness's punitive expedition.
Yes, yes. It will need to be,
sighed Grendine, her mind already working.
Schedule a meeting of court for later this morning. We shall make the announcement then, she decided. Let's get you settled into your quarters,
she said, fussing with Radine's hair,
and then we can catch up. Thank you, Anguin,
she said genuinely, as she embraced her daughter again.
And thank you, our noble wizards. Despite your humility, I suspect your role was larger than you let on. It will not be forgotten.
She'll forget about this as soon as there's news from Faris, Duke Anguin said sourly as we walked the new garden in front of the palace.
Radine was still closeted with her family, while the castellans of the palace sent word of the court, so the lads and I spent the time touring the new complex and gardens.
Indeed, I feel she will regret her boon and the rescue itself in time.
As long as she doesn't forget the baronies, Tyndall commented, and your sisters.
Yes, that will be helpful, Anguin agreed. I barely recognized them when I saw them last.
Radine said that this would be the best time to ask for their release. Her mother wanted to marry them off, herself, to loyal Castali lords, who would then have a claim on their supposed dowries back in an Ultramar.
You are taking advice from your cousin now, I asked, surprised.
She's changed,
Anguin admitted guiltily. Oh, she's still the same crabby, arrogant little princess she always was. But I think her time imprisoned gave her an opportunity to reflect, particularly upon her parents' lack of action in rescuing her.
When she heard that Tavard was using her imprisonment as a pretext for an invasion of people who didn't even capture her or were holding her, she was livid. Her mother has had designs on Alshar her entire life. To see her use her captivity as a point of leverage in that quest? Well, I believe it changed her perspective, he said tactfully.
I bet she's giving them an earful right now, Tyndall said,
staring back at the Grand Palace. She's not the type to mince words. She's been quietly using her contacts in court to find out what's going on all week, without revealing herself. Anguin nodded. She was not pleased by what she heard. Indeed, she feels rejected and abandoned. Considering all that she's been asked to do for her family, he said meaningfully, she feels betrayed by those who were supposed to protect her. So, while I do not doubt her loyalty to the crown, her happiness with her father and mother are in question. I honestly feel for her, Rundle said, shaking his head. She was already having a hard time finding a husband. Now that she's been a prisoner, that's going to get even harder.
I bet they'll try to stash her in an abbey,
guessed Tyndall. Some big prestigious abbey that proves the family's piety, and where she'll stay quiet.
Oh, I don't think they'd be well served to do that, chuckled Anguin.
Within a year, she'd be High Priestess. Within five, she'd be on the Royal Ecclesiastic Council, only this time with the power of religious law at her disposal. That would also put her beyond the reach of her brother, he added.
Somehow, I don't see Ra'Din content with a life of holy orders, I agreed. She was weaned on power, and she will find some way to gain it if she lacks. But I don't think she would move in opposition to her mother.
Don't you have five sisters, Master? Rondal asked. Have none of them ever contested with your mother?
A fair point, I conceded, remembering the legendary arguments my various sisters had with Mum.
Perhaps she would. But without a power base, there's little Ra'Din could accomplish if her mother was set against her. I'm guessing they'll try to use her to cement an alliance with one of the other duchies, if she found no suitors in Faris. I'm sure there's some rich old geezer in Vor who's deaf enough to marry her.
She'd hate that, Anguin observed. She'd be in a completely foreign land without any real power base. It would be as good as exile.
I think that was my master's point, Your Grace, Tyndall suggested. I got the distinct impression that, for all of their relief and joy at seeing her alive again, that they were afraid of her. They want to see her safe, but safely out of the way. We were joined shortly by Master Hartarian, who wished to hear a first-hand account of the news himself. We enjoyed spending an hour recounting the details of the raid on Olam Saheri and much of what we discovered there. But he was disturbed about the implications, though he was ignorant of much of my larger concerns.
We cannot allow such a place to grow, even at the farthest edge of the kingdom, he declared. You may have struck a decided blow, but you did not end the threat.
At most, I bought us a few months of time, I agreed.
From what the Kasari scouts report, they have already begun establishing fortresses throughout the Land of Scars, and garrisoning them with hobgoblins, and undead. Put an emavort in each one, and they'd be tough to remove.
It's not as large a matter with an Ultramar sealed off behind its northern walls right now, he agreed. But when the duchy is reunited, those forts will be perfectly placed to divide it again.
That may not be within our lifetimes, particularly if the Count of Reims declares himself duke, Rundle observed. He will see the way stay sealed. An Ultramar has a grand armada. They do not need to trade overland.
Why, do you doubt our noble prince's brave expedition to crush the rebels, Sir Rondal?
Hartarian asked with a wry grin.
Candidly, I doubt His Highness's ability to find his arse with both hands. It's not merely the Alshari fleet he faces. The Farisi navy and a great number of privateers have joined the raiding fleets of the rebels. That's well over 300 ships to Tavard's 100, and they are not armed merchantmen, he reminded. They are warships and raiders, and they are sailing in their territorial waters.
You seem incredibly well informed about such matters, Sir Rundle,
Hartarian said appraisingly.
An academic interest?
The Astasi Order has had reason to infiltrate rebellious an Ultramar of late, Rundle conceded, glancing at Tyndall.
We had some errantry with the Brotherhood of the Rat. Along the way, we picked up some intelligence on the local situation.
So, You're telling me that we may have to mount a rescue operation for Prince Tavard, after just concluding one for Princess Radin? He asked, half horrified and half amused.
We would have to check our schedule, my lord, to see if we had other engagements, Rondal smirked.
It was the slave trade that was the most troubling, Tyndall added thoughtfully. Since the rebellion, the five counts have permitted the practice, even encouraged it, as they profited in many ways from it. It allowed the inland lords to dispossess their free peasantry and replace them with slaves. With supply so steady, it is cheaper to purchase a man for a lifetime at market than pay him out wages for his service over many years. Now free men go without work and are being evicted from their cots while slaves toil under the lash, he pronounced, disgusted.
Any who do not support the industry are condemned as disloyal, Rondal continued gravely.
Even lords who despise the practice are forced into it as their neighbours and competitors profit. The dispossessed peasantry are doubly injured. As if they are not wary, they might wake to discover themselves 50 miles downriver, a collar on their necks and a slave trader beating their new name into their head.
It is a crime and an affront to my ancestors' pledge against the practice, Anguin frowned.
As it is being used to line the purses of those who would see me deposed as well, it is doubly foul in my mind.
The Al-Shari never seemed to mind piracy before, Arterian observed wryly.
He had a point. Even during the periods of best relations between the duchies, the Al-Shari fleet continued to capture ships, sell them and their cargoes at market, and ransom the passengers. Taking prisoners' ransom at sea is one thing. Enslaving the entire crew and auctioning them off next to the cargo of their captured ships is quite another, Anguin, the descendant of sea lords, insisted. When we take a ship in the shallow sea, it is a prize of war. The cargo and ransoms are fair recompense. Condemning the crew to involuntary servitude is not.
Then should we not have supported Tavard to a greater extent and end this threat?
Arterian asked. He wasn't trying to make a political point. It was an honest question.
It is not a question of support,
Anguin countered. Tavard could have hired double the number of ships, and he would still lose. The Al-Shari fleet is massive in both number and size. The men are marine warriors, not mere mercenary sailors. It would take years to build a fleet that could challenge it at sea. My cousin was foolish for trying, or being advised by fools, he added. The only way to stop the practice is to deprive them of the market, which is what my father and grandfather tried to do, and it worked until the rebellion. Now Korbal has infiltrated the rebels in part, I explained.
What?
Arterian asked, troubled. The southeastern swamps are being seeded with undead from Olam Saheri. They seek in particular for talented folk, for they can use our bodies as hosts for the enshadowed, those known as the Nemovorti. Powerful undead, with significant necromantic and thaumaturgical abilities.
Some of them know how to fight, too, agreed Tyndall.
Tough bastards, armed with Drudrian-forged weapons. You can't even really kill them. When they die, they already have another body waiting for them.
We're facing an even more powerful foe now, Arterian, I quietly informed him. As bad as Shirul was, he was fairly straightforward in his intentions.
Korbal is another matter. He's shrewd and insidious, and more than willing to use our own weaknesses against us.
Isn't that preferable to genocide?
Arterian pointed out.
Perhaps, my lord, Anguin suggested. I went to Olam Saheri. I saw those things with my own eyes. From what my gentlemen have told me, the same creatures were sighted in an ultramar. No doubt they are taking advantage of the slave trade as well. Rumours persist that dead peasants now work the fields and paddies of Karamas, tirelessly producing food for sale at market, the profits from which are invested into fresh slaves. The Gavani can be fought on the battlefield and are easy to identify, the young duke continued thoughtfully. The Nemovorti strike at us through our own humanity. We can last generations fighting the Gavani against their genocide. We will have far less time to resist the infiltration of those who can take the bodies of our own people.
A fair point, Your Grace,
Arterian conceded.
Ah, it appears that Her Highness is at liberty now, he observed, as we watched Radin virtually explode out of the palace door, startle the guards, and stomp down the steps to where we were waiting. My lords, she said,
her face red and her cheeks puffy.
I believe we are done here for the day.
Is there not a court plan for later this morning, Your Highness? I asked, confused.
Aye, and it shall proceed without me,
she said hotly. The announcement of both my rescue and the name of my rescuer will be made, but I will be too indisposed from my ordeal to be present, she finished bitterly.
What? Why?
Anguin asked, confused.
Mother decided that it was too disruptive to reintroduce me at court, what with my brother and heir to the throne at sea.
Her eyes narrowed.
It's my sister-in-law, she decided. That's who she's protecting, that flat-headed, big-boobed Rumiran bitch and her brawling new brat. She's afraid of pissing off our Mandra.
Her Majesty's great and abiding affection for her grandson is well known, Artarian said, tactfully.
I just met the little turd,
Radin fumed, and he's no cuter than any other babe. But that bitch whispered a few words to Mother, and suddenly I'm to be sent to a convent so that I can recover my constitution. Well, I will not stand for it. She turned to Anguin.
My cousin, you have been so kind, but I would beg a boon from you. Can you give me refuge in Verone? For I fear if I stay in this pretty pit of vipers for even one night, my beloved sister-in-law will see it my last.
You think she'd have you assassinated? Tyndall asked, his eyes wide. He'd seen Radin in action before. The idea that the mistress of assassins could herself fall prey to the art was disturbing. The princess snorted.
She has neither the commitment nor the means to do a decent job, she said. She's as stupid as a fence-post. She might wish to see me dead, but she isn't bold enough to do the job properly, despite the Ramiran's vaunted reputation as poisonous. Nonetheless, she continued, I don't feel entirely safe here now. The politics of the palace has changed,
she admitted uncomfortably.
I could see that just in the way the servants reacted to me.
I found that ironic, coming from a girl, a woman, whose perspective had changed so dramatically herself.
Of course you may stay at my estate as long as you wish,
Anguin assured her. My home, such as it is your home. But are you certain? Radin, I know you are upset with them, but—
Oh, this is not mere childish lashing out,
she insisted. I know it may seem that way, but it isn't.
Not really. This is a coldly calculated political move. Once I go into that abbey, I'm essentially resigning myself to my mother's control over my fate. After she failed to make even one effort to secure my release, and then used it to justify Tavard's vainglory, she no longer has that right, she said proudly.
Won't she just summon you home? Asked Tyndall doubtfully.
Let her try,
Radin said, with menace in her voice.
I can tell when I am no longer wanted. I will not force them to endure my presence 1 hour more than necessary. If that means living in rustic Verone for a while, well, I've enjoyed worse accommodations and far worse company of late. I think I can endure it. The question is, can you?
She asked her cousin quietly.
I don't want to put you in a difficult position, Anguin, but I honestly don't have anywhere else to go, she admitted. I have 12 estates, but each one is seeded with her spies and assassins already. I would not be safe there.
Your mother's reach extends to the Wilderlands, I reminded her. She snorted again.
Who do you think extended it there? I will handle that, she promised. At least in Verone I know who to be wary of. Believe me, my lords, Mother made it abundantly clear when she tried to stuff me in a habit and seal me away from the world in an abbey. I am a danger to the orderly succession of my squealing little nephew, and that will not be tolerated by his doting grandmother or his insipid mother. Here in Kaunas, Castabriel, anywhere in Castor. I am in peril, she said sadly.
Chapter 52 Repose and Reflection.
Well, wasn't that odd? Tyndall mused, as we exited the ways into my workshop, after returning Anguin to Verone. The lads wanted to spend a few days in Sevendor soaking up luxury and spending some coin, and I couldn't blame them. They'd been in the Wilderlands for weeks, and then endured one of the longest and most challenging battles of the entire war. They had, literally, tackled Corbal the Necromancer,
Now all they wanted to do was drink and dance. I couldn't say I blamed them. I found I desperately needed a moment of repose and reflection after concluding Radin's redemption to her family. Being back in my tower with the lads gave me that chance.
Odd is an understatement, Rundle agreed, flopping down on the padded bench near the fire, which he ignited with a wave of his hand. Who would have thought such a ruthless daughter would get such a chilly reception from such a heartless cunt?
Oh, she's not heartless, I disagreed, taking a seat in my customary chair. It was getting a little ratty, but I didn't mind. She's merely being opportunistic. She has a grandchild now, one who will one day sit on the throne. That is her ultimate validation. Not having a couple more potential rival claimants from a cadet marriage, so seeing Radin's womb locked behind convent walls has appeal.
It's bloody outrageous, if you ask me, Tyndall said. I mean, I dislike her intensely, don't misunderstand. But to be so faithful to a cause for so long, only to be cast away with chastity your only reward, he said, shaking his head as if the prospect was worse than death. It's just cruel.
That's court politics, I shrugged. At least Anguin gave her safe passage and a secure exile, I said, summoning wine from the huckster in the chair. It kept the help from taking clandestine sips. That was just as unexpected, after what she did to him.
That produced an exchange of meaningful glances between the two, a meaning that escaped me.
What? I demanded.
What do you know?
They continued to stare at each other a moment, no doubt sharing a mind-to-mind conversation. Then Rundle sighed.
Master, we've noticed a certain tension between Anguin and Radin since Ulam Saheri, he admitted.
What? I asked, startled.
You mean we could be mistaken, Tyndall said, hurriedly.
We're probably mistaken, Rundle said apologetically, but not convincingly.
But there's something there between them.
Oh, dear, I sighed. Are you certain it isn't just a natural gratitude for her rescue?
From that cynical young princess? Tyndall asked, careful of his choice of words.
Master, I have no doubt that she can feign whatever emotion she needs to for whatever occasion she needs, if it means getting the right dagger into the right kidney.
But some things you cannot counterfeit, he said with some authority. According to the 16 laws, she's smitten, he pronounced, as if he'd just learned his friend the Duke had the pox and would never recover.
That in itself would not be so disturbing if the orphan Duke did not seem to return her interest, Rundle said. He blames her mother, not Radin, for his parents' deaths. Of course, he could be rationalizing away his infatuation, he considered. Or he could be maneuvering into a position of weakness so that he can strike at her when she least expects it, proposed Tyndall, with more enthusiasm. More likely he's a lonely young man who is starting to think about his future in the presence of a social peer, I proposed, sipping the wine while I dug out my pipe. I needed a moment in the relative serenity of my chamber after a day like today.
She's a lovely young woman, objectively speaking, I pointed out.
There are fairer flowers by the dozen in the gardens of her own, assured Tyndall, but her vulnerability is likely appealing, and her intellect. She might be a vicious, brutal monster, but that would make her fallen estate all the more alluring to Anguin. He sees himself as dispossessed and rejected. Common cause between them, in opposition to the royal court, could provide the element needed to spark an attraction, he admitted.
You sound like a priestess of Ishii.
Is she not his cousin? Rundle pointed out, crinkling his brow. Such matters fade in importance among the very high-born and the very low, I observed. Surely you fellows knew of a few families on the ridges in the Mindens whose cousins married? They exchanged guilty glances. That wasn't something that was spoken of among polite Wilderlands folk. The issue of blood only becomes an issue if there is a marriage, I pointed out. We are miles upriver from that. Let the poor girl lick her wounds, and if she and Anguin find some temporary comfort with each other, do not discourage it, I advised. Knowing how volatile and imperious she can be, I doubt it will come to fruit. But it bears watching, so watch it for me, I requested.
We will, Master,
Rondell agreed, but it would help if we didn't shudder every time we watched.
I have 5 sisters, I reminded them. I've not always been pleased with their choice of quarters. Some of those fellows are now related to me. And speaking of sisters, what of Anguin's? Does he really want to marry them off? I asked, concerned. Mostly, he just wants them out of Grendene's control, Rondell supplied. He's trying to re-establish the ducal house. Taking control of his family's destiny is a step up that mountain, and he misses them, Rondell suggested. He's actually quite sentimental when he lets himself be. So was his father, and it diminished his rule by all accounts, I reminded them. Anguin is not his father, Tyndall said defensively. Believe me, he's ruling just fine in Varone. The city is prospering, the farms are producing, and no one is starving to death anymore. After this raid, he said, thinking of the summer capital fondly, there will be even more revels when the Wilderlords return from the field to celebrate. The return of his sisters to Alshar will be a tangible sign of his mastery, agreed Rondell, ignoring his friend's priorities, as will the addition of 2 Gilmoran baronies to his rule. Even as a vassal of Tavard for those estates, they will essentially be a part of Alshar, from a policy perspective. The richest part of Anguin's Alshar, he added. Even if they are a mess since the invasion, there are still more people there than the Wilderlands. But to the Alshari, it will be the first return of Gilmoran territory to direct Alshari control in 50 years. That won't hurt his reputation in the south, Tyndall agreed. Especially after, he said, trailing off guiltily. Rondell looked at him sharply. What? I demanded. What did you do?
We indulged in a little subversive politics, Rondell admitted, suddenly finding a thread in the knee of his hose that needed his attention. We were concerned that the 5 counts were moving too hastily toward electing one of their number. The Count of Reims, supplied Tyndall. Thicketroll, nasty piece of work. To the coronet, continued Rondell. Despite not actually possessing either the coronet of Alshar or the shard of the crown, he'd control the majority of Alshar, which makes him the duke if the sitting counts and barons say he's the duke. So, we reminded the contentious assembly of nobility that there is already a duke of Alshar, and he resides in the official summer capital of his realm, and that he would someday be returning to hold the nobility to account for their governance of his realm in his absence, Tyndall added. We tucked the note into a dragon skull. The one we slew at Varone, not the one on display in Castabriel, Rondell clarified. We felt a certain possession over the thing since we killed it, he reminded me, and dropped it into the middle of their assembly from a Hoxter pocket. Tyndall finished triumphantly. You should have seen it, Master. It was incredible. It did produce a profound reaction among the nobility, Rondell agreed, with a smug smile, and worked toward the desired result. Talk of an absent monarch was muted after that, as was the previously prevalent notion that the orphan duke was a powerless puppet of Rad and Grendene. The leading nobles seemed to proceed more cautiously with their discussions of electing a new duke with a rotting dragon head in the middle of the room. I looked back and forth between the two of them. I was tempted to be mad at the caper. It was fraught with danger, physical, magical, and political. But I was once again struck with how daring, impulsive, and impetuous my boys were, and my recent conversation with Onranian. Those were the same qualities he both admired in me and considered threatening to the Alca-Alon Council. While I wasn't above a little judicious hypocrisy, I couldn't very well condemn them for those same traits, particularly if it achieved the desired result. I concluded, after a moment's consideration, that while it may not have been what I would have done under the circumstances, it wasn't a bad play. Inspired, even. Well done, gentlemen, I conceded with a chuckle. Anguin is well served by you. A little dramatic, perhaps, but look, we figure it will be years before Anguin will be in a position to make a real play for an Ultramar, Rondell explained reasonably. In the meantime, our best use is to keep any pretenders to the coronet from consolidating their positions. I held up my hands. That, gentlemen, is an Alshari affair, I reminded them. I am a Castali baron.
What you don't discuss with me, I cannot be compelled to pass along to my liege lord.
Oh, we know you'd never tell him something like that, master, dismissed Tyndall, finishing his wine.
We all have our duties. I swore an oath of loyalty. I will not be in danger of breaking it if I do not know something that I shouldn't.
A fair point, master, Rondell agreed, as the door to the great hall burst open.
Darrow was standing there, looking ragged and haggard, despite having been freshly bathed and dressed. She looked around at the three of us, gave a disgusted sigh, and collapsed on the bench next to Rondell.
Please tell me this isn't one of those journeyman-only affairs, she said bitterly. Someone pour me some wine.
What's wrong? I asked, frowning. I had checked on Darrow briefly after I'd awakened to make certain she was doing all right, but I'd been too busy since then to follow up. I knew she'd left Timberwatch after I'd gone to the Tower of Refuge, along with her injured wing of Skyriders.
What is right?
She countered. Out of four wings, I have a wing and a half of riders left. Six dead riders and four dead birds, she said, depressed. Five others are too wounded to fly any time soon.
Fretful might never fly again.
I'm sorry, Darrow. I sighed. I thought we had an answer for the Wyvern problem.
Mostly you did.
She frowned. That's the thing. Things were going really well, until they weren't. It wasn't until we went out over the water that we got into trouble, she reflected. I'm just glad Frightful wasn't involved. How are her chicks doing? That changed her mood for the better. The female I'm calling Fatty for how much she eats, she said proudly, and the male is littler, but he's perfect. I'm calling him Faultless, she reported with a faint smile. But it will be months before I have two full wings, flight-worthy master, she sighed. I had to send word to their families, she added sullenly. I'm sorry.
Don't be,
I soothed. It's the worst part of being a military commander. You and your riders did remarkably well, Darrow, under trying circumstances, against an unknown foe. You should take a tremendous amount of pride in that.
I do,
she nodded with a sigh, but I need to recruit more riders now.
That's always hard,
she yawned, and tomorrow I have to muck out the Muse Tower short-handed. Yuck, she said, making a face. We'll find them, I assured her. If it makes you feel better, I get to hear about the accounting all day tomorrow with Bannermore. I'm thinking I prefer the Muse, I chuckled.
Actually,
she said, leaning back tiredly,
so do I.
I met Bannermore the next day at his customary table at the market. It was a market day, the small market, mostly farmers' produce and trade goods, but the weather was nice. There were enough clouds in the sky to keep it from being hot, and a bit of a breeze coming across Southridge from Hosendore. The Elf's Gap, it was being called now, for the traffic across the bridge from Sevendore to the Terra Alon Manor. It took an hour to catch Bannermore up on all the important developments surrounding the raid on Olam Saheri, which he found fascinating. Bannermore isn't the adventurous type anymore, but he appreciated a good yarn, and he liked to know about the big, important events going on for business purposes. Rardine left the palace and went to Varan, he finally asked when I finished with the news. That was the big thing you took away from that story? I asked, incredulous. That was the more important part, he shrugged, to me at least. That kind of watershed in the court can have ripples far downstream. If our sister-in-law really does have Grandine's backing, now that's significant.
If you say so,
I shrugged. It just means that court functions are going to be a lot more interesting now. So, how fares the Wizard Trading Company?
Arcane Mercantile Company,
he corrected. We're already profitable, he admitted. On parchment, we made a profit of 16 roses, 7 stags, on the first run from Sevendore to Wilderhall. The caravan should be headed back out in another 2 weeks, he added proudly. We've another one headed for Wenshaw, a full 20 wains. I frowned. That doesn't sound like a lot.
That's the Blue Book,
he confided, our public trading records. The magical stuff we cart to market. The Yellow Book, on the other hand, is our more clandestine accounts, the ones involving smuggling bulk, trade, and luxury goods through the hucksters. And the Yellow Book, my friend, is bulging. So far, this month alone, the company has profited nearly 700 roses. He smiled, pleased.
Remeran wine and grain for Alshari, pig iron, lead and timber, mostly, but we're expanding. By the end of the summer, we should have at least 4 trading houses with 7 Doras, the mother house. And everyone understands the need for discretion. Oh, it is our watchword, Bannermore chuckled. No one wants to pay tax on that kind of fare. And how are the profits distributed? I asked curiously, as I watched peasant girls sell eggs and cheese next to tall maids hawking carrots and potatoes. The chief of each house takes a rose every month for upkeep, and 6 silver stags for overhead. Then he takes 1/4 of the profit for himself, as verified by my accounting. The other 3/4 of the profit goes to the company. 1/4 is invested in new ventures, 1/4 in increasing stock, and 1/4 is distributed amongst the gentlemen members of the association, paid out 2x a year, he added. That's a lot of complicated accounting, I pointed out, my head swimming. 2 sets, 1 for the Duke's taxman, 1 for us, he agreed, but I've hired 2 clerks from the Temple of Ifnia to assist. They will be discreet, of course, he added. Of course, I nodded. How go preparations for the fair? He groaned. Of course you would ask me about that. It's in the bloody chamber pot with Gareth gone. Ah, we'll muddle through, he sighed, but things ran a lot more smoothly when that lad was overseeing everything. I've got 4 men doing the job he did, 4 expensive men, but it should be well attended. The academic theme this year is Rajira. It should be about as boring and dry a subject as magical history, but an important one, he conceded. We're seeing more and more of it pop up around Sevendor, he added. We have a lot of magi about, I nodded. That stands to reason, especially with all that snowstone sitting there. Recognizing, measuring, and evaluating Rajira might be boring, but it's useful. That's what I thought, he agreed, but that's a long-term problem. We have short-term problems? I asked, surprised. Is water wet? He scoffed. Nothing that cannot be dealt with, but there are always short-term problems. People have been asking questions about our missing mountain, he said, glancing at the elf's gap, wondering what happened to it. Dismiss it as the spellmonger's secret project and act all mysterious, I proposed. That's what I've been doing, but, well, people gossip. It's not a serious issue, largely because the new trade from Hosendor has been good, but let them talk, I dismissed. They will anyway. It will pass. I'll pull some new wonder out of my ass, and no one will think about it anymore. I would have thought that the divine visitation would have overshadowed a mere missing mountain. Oh, it has, he snorted. That entire episode has been a right pain in my ass. The shrine is under construction, and it will be delightful, I have no doubt. But it forces me to reorganize the entire fair, and now we have to staff it, and likely build an inn nearby, he grumbled, right in the middle of the new traffic through the gap. Rich men's problems, I grunted. I'll take them over an empty belly and holes in my boots, he agreed, smiling. If you think Lady Alia will be back soon, I'd count myself a lucky man if I died tomorrow. Then his face fell. He looked troubled. There is one other thing, he said quietly. We've started to get some ecclesiastic issues with the agricultural ones. Ecclesiastic issues? We made certain that the Huinites were supportive of them. It isn't Huin who's the problem. I've heard tale of a priestess of Kolita preaching in the veils against the ones. That was trouble. While Huin was the revered, amongst the peasantry at least, Narasi god of the fields and grain, he was not the only agricultural god around. There were others, mostly local and regional deities who hadn't been syncretized with Huin. Some were mere folk cults, others had priesthoods and even shrines and temples. Most of them were pretty benign, but a few of them were problematic. Kolita was one of those. Originally a small-time goddess of fruit trees, berry bushes and vegetable gardens in the distant valleys of Merwin, before the conquest. Once she came into contact with my brutal Narasi ancestors, Kolita and her priesthood changed. She became a defiant figure of imperial resistance at first, one of the divinities that the dukes couldn't come up with a reason to suppress. But unlike her grain-focused Narasi counterpart, Kalita's divine message came complete with an ideology. Kolita preached
that the only worthy endeavour for man was cultivation. It was man's divine purpose, the industry from which all other culture flowed. Lords, knights, craftsmen, all were secondary in importance to the peasant farmer in Kalita's rustic catechism. That became a problem after the conquest. She became a figure of passive resistance to Narasi rule in Merwin and Vore, and as the other regions of the Majocracy fell to my barbarian ancestors, her cult spread quietly among the rural folk. While Huin was a relatively placid divinity, Kalita's clergy had a habit of whipping up resentment against established social orders. While Huin's priesthood had certainly been behind its share of peasants' uprisings, Kalita's priesthood's rebellions tended to be bloody. They were also terribly effective. Whereas Huin was a supporter of the established order, Kalita preached against it. She was a fiery rebel, always willing to come to the aid of a peasantry beset by injustice. Some lords tried to suppress the cult, but the truth was that such actions merely validated the egalitarian message of oppression Kalita manifested to combat.
That is troubling, I agreed. What is their complaint?
That the agricultural ones robbed the farmer of his honest toil. Without the necessity of a plough, there is no need for a ploughman, or to rent a team. They couch it as a plot to starve the common folk and enrich the gentry.
Well, the last part is true enough, I conceded, but it enriches the peasants who own their strips too, I pointed out. They get the benefits of the wands.
And they are in the minority, Bannermore pointed out. Most peasants rent their land from the manor on credit and count on paying it back with money made selling their labour to the manor and the other agricultural jobs. Two families in 10 might actually own their strips and rent to make up the difference, or rent them out to others to farm. But now that ploughing is so much cheaper, he continued in his matter-of-fact voice, and harvest has been reduced to sheaving, threshing, winnowing and gleaning, the manors just don't need the labour they did 3 years ago. So they're only spending a fraction, and now people are competing heavily for those few low-paying jobs. Evictions have started, he said worriedly. Folk who couldn't pay their rent on their strips had their crops confiscated last harvest. Now they're starting to get turned out of their cots. That gives Kalita's lot fertile ground in which to plant the seed of revolt. I nodded, understanding. Peasants' revolts were nasty things. Keep an eye on it, I advised. Let me know if there's anything we can do. Well, as a result, labour is cheap at the moment, he continued. I realised I had fallen into his trap. And with most of Seven Dwarfs' labour employed in constructing that lovely new bridge complex over the former mountain, most of our municipal projects have stalled. I'd like to hire a few hundred folk and get them restarted, and I have a dozen new ones that we need to start. It might inject some silver into the local economies outside of the domain too, he persuaded.
Sure. Go ahead.
I shrugged. We have the money. With princes, gods and emissaries from strange races dropping by at all hours, I suppose we should make the place pretty. What did you have in mind? 20 minutes later, I regretted asking. Gaining a new ducal charter had emboldened Bannermore, and the Sevendor town council he led as Lord Mayor was enjoying unheard-of prosperity at the moment. Bannermore wanted to embark on a program of civic development that would make Sevendor the equal of any city in Castile. He wanted to change the streets around, relocate some residence areas, develop the spot on the commons around the shrine, pave the rest of Sevendor's main roads, and a score of other projects that would beautify and, Bannermore's goal, enrich Sevendor, town, domain, and barony. His plan entailed spending hundreds of roses and thousands of stags. Using the threat of Kalita's priesthood to put me in the right frame of mind, he leveraged the pitch toward his own investment.
I approve, I said, rubbing my eyes. Yes, yes, by all means, let's spend some of this gold we have.
It gets so lonely when you leave it in a vault all by itself, Bannermore agreed. But when I'm done, we'll have everything a major ducal city has, except for slums. Sevendor Town will be something to be proud of. I'm already proud of it, I affirmed. We have mage lights in the streets, magically running fountains, 2 markets, a fair and a lovely market square, I pointed out, waving to the hubbub around us. We have the only fully functioning bouleuterion in the world, a thriving guild community, and the respect and admiration of our neighbours.
Yeah, Bannermore sighed.
Things are looking rosy right now. I wonder how long that will last.
Not long, I prophesied. You were right to pay attention to Radin. She represents a threat to the current order. Then again, so do we. With Tavard out at sea, things should be stable for a while, probably through summer, right up to this autumn's Curia. After that, depending on whether or not Tavard gets himself killed on his naval expedition, things could get hairy among the upper nobility. If that happens, all of this might be dashed to bits.
Well, you're a cheery fellow,
Bannermore fumed, but probably right. The Riverlands would be the first place that trouble would start, too. Let's try to keep things safe and prosperous here as long as we can, he proposed. That's what I'm doing, I agreed. Sometimes that seems like that's all I'm doing. My kids live here, I pointed out. I want them to have someplace safe and secure to grow up in and eventually inherit. Speaking of which, I've got a date to go pick them up from my sister and take them to the pond for swimming today, I said, standing. After which we'll go to the bathhouse and then come to the Alembic for dinner, where they will undo all the good work the bathhouse did.
Well, this might disturb your day then,
he grunted, taking a small scroll of parchment out of his sleeve. I stopped by the mirror array on my way here, like I do every morning. Our adepts make a point of sending important news along for my private preview, under the wands, so to speak, he said mischievously. This was waiting for me. It came in during last night's shift. He handed me the paper and I unrolled it. It was a report from the Faresian Mirror Adept, personally, directed to Bannermore. It reported that Tavard had set sail the day before with a fleet of 110 ships, after he confiscated 6 more ships at Faris under his father's name. A great battle had ensued in the shallow sea as the Alshari Armada had pounced on the bait. No result of the battle was known. No ship had returned from the Castali fleet with word. Chapter 53 The Bridge to Tua Vakothel. Hosendor is a pretty place. While I'm partial to the security Sevendor's surrounding mountains gave me, the foothill domain to the east was poor agricultural land, but the same rough country that made it difficult to bring a crop to market also provided a beautiful geological canvas upon which nature could paint. Hosendor was replete with waterfalls and tiny pools from the multitude of springs on the eastern side of the ridge. There were some delightful little grottos, not too far off the road, the perfect place to picnic, or to lie in wait of picnickers. One of these delightful little places had been twice transformed. First, during the night my son was born, a largish outcropping on the eastern side of the ridge was affected. It was as snow-white as any snowstone in Sevendor. But then the small estate that owned the outcropping was gifted to Lord Eratas and the Terra Alon, after we came to Fallen and Thatiel's aid. He renamed it Tua Vakothel. He'd built a refuge there for his folk in exile. His people had fallen on the dainty clearing and constructed an entire complex of buildings on the site. They'd quarried the snowstone outcropping for the foundations of the central hall, and raised it in Alka Alon fashion, only to Terra Alon height requirements. The effect was intriguing, reflective of the dual nature of the Terra Alon. The central hall epitomized this. It was a round, multi-storied structure on snowstone foundations, similar in style, I realized, to the Tower of Refuge. Each successive story was smaller than the one below, but encapsulated by it with an uneven edge. That allowed each floor a dramatic balcony, one that was filled with planters and pots containing the trees and shrubs the tree folk were so fond of. But there were human touches as well. The most obvious was the most subtle. This place had been built with the Terra Alon in mind, not the Alka Alon. The doorways were gracefully pointed arches. There were stairs instead of ramps, and there was actual furniture within, not just a bunch of pillows. There were also guards. Tua Vakothel was as much military camp as refugee camp, and those who had sworn the oath to keep their Terra Alon bodies until the war against Korbal was won were returning from their first sortie against the hated despoiler of their once fair city. The returning veterans had raised hope among the others, and now they were practicing the arts of war in the yards and the butts, just like their Humani neighbours. When Lady Fallowen agreed to meet with me about her father's death, she bid me come here alone. She would not even bring her new husband from Hosendor Castle. She met me in her chamber, an exquisitely beautiful tangle of natural alkan themes that conspired to suggest a forest environment. Fallowen wore a black, Riverlord-style, sideless surcoat. Indeed, apart from her unworldly beauty, pointed ears, and complexion, she might have been any noble woman in the Vales. I broke the news to her, relaying the details as quickly and completely as I could. I told her about the treacherous Nemavort, my sin Amana, stabbing him in the back, and about how I raised both him and her mother into the spare bodies. She took it well, I suppose. Hearing that your sainted parents are now undead guardians in the basement of the house you grew up in is a little distressing. Hearing he died by the same hands that slew her mother only intensified her hatred of the Enshadowed. With your father's passing, that means you are the heir to Anthatiel, I informed her unnecessarily.
Heir? To a ruined city in our enemy's hands?
She asked, some very Humani tears rolling down her fair cheek.
I knew he wasn't going to come back from there, she said bitterly. I could see it in his eyes. Aye, he promised me that he would live if I did as he bid and married, but I could tell. He never intended upon returning.
Do you take any solace in his reunion with your mother?
Of course, she dismissed. I've missed her desperately since she died, and father has been devastated for centuries, but to leave them in such a state.
I was rushed, I admitted, but it seemed the best idea at the time. My first real dabbling with necromancy, but with the handmaiden's help they awoke almost as good as if they were living.
Thank you for bearing this news, my lord,
she said quietly, after wiping her eyes. I suppose I must rise to the necessity of the occasion, and take leadership of my
people,
she said, sounding defeated. It's a hard responsibility, I agreed. When I took responsibilities for the Bovali refugees, who weren't even my people, it seemed overwhelming. But the Terra Alon who fought with us at Olam Saheri were valiant, and they are loyal to your house, I reminded her. They were dedicated to your father, and if you invoke their loyalty, they will transfer it to you. If it seems too daunting a task to lead them, then select among them a leader willing to bear the load, and delegate. She nodded unconvincingly.
Here I am, trying to learn to be a Humani wife. No easy task, my lord, and now I must learn to be a general and a lord of Terra Alon, she said miserably. How am I to manage either one?
She pleaded. You do your best, and hope no one notices how terrified you are of screwing up, I counseled. That's what I do. You are in a unique position, my lady, I explained. The Terra Alon are a new people, a mixture of mine and yours. It is in their very name. The expectations that would fall upon you as an Alkan noblewoman do not completely apply. Neither, I added, looking at her in her comparatively frumpy, sideless surcoat, do Humani standards. You are as unique in your position as the people you lead.
And how is that to bring me comfort?
She asked, looking miserable. Comfort? There's no comfort there, my lady, I agreed, but there is wisdom. As the Terra Alon are new, there is no one who can contest that your leadership of them falls short of tradition or history. They need a leader who can navigate through the difficult lands ahead, one who is not afraid of making decisions, even compromises, to ensure the survival, security, and prosperity of her people. That is what will matter to them, and perhaps to the Council.
What about the Council?
She asked sharply. Well, as the heir to Anthatiel, do you not inherit your sire's seat on the council? I pointed out.
Eratas had a seat on the council because Anthatiel was a great city, she countered. Now it is a ruin, and its people exiled. Why should I be permitted to serve when the power the seat represents is gone?
The strength of a land is in its people, I counseled. Though their city is ruined, they can build another. They are determined to drive Korbel and the Enshadowed away from Olam Saheri and cleanse the place. It follows that they will rebuild the city after victory. They revered your father, and look to you as his daughter to guide them. You need but guide them and keep them together as they journey toward that end. She pursed her lips.
You are wise, spellmonger,
she agreed. I have been so preoccupied about what this means to me, I have forgotten what it means to my folk.
In truth,
she confessed, my lord husband said much the same thing ere I departed Hosendorf Castle, but I dismissed it. It is hard to take the counsel of mortals sometimes. Of course, I smiled. What could we possibly know? You were born before my great-great-grandsire, were you not? How fares your marriage? You may be candid, I added. Anything you tell me will be held in strictest confidence. She stared at me a while, lightly considering how candid to be.
It is far less troublesome than I anticipated in some ways, she admitted. In others it is far more. My human kin, she said, making a face at the word, have been nothing but kind and welcoming. They behave with deference, but not with the worship of the Tal Alon, nor have they tried to constrain me, as I feared.
And Sire Rife?
My lord husband loves me more now than the day we wed, she answered. His devotion is sincere, and his passions surprisingly gentle, she said. Of course, this clumsy body catches his eye regularly, but he is starting to get to know the wife within.
He has not been abusive in any way, I asked cautiously. It was a delicate topic, but among most river lords, domestic violence was common.
On the contrary, he has been doting, she said, shaking her head.
Rife is a noble man, and he desires my love freely given. He would never wish to compel it. That is good to hear, I nodded.
Besides, I have nearly 1,000 troops in his domain, she added, gesturing around her. If I took offense at something he did, I have recourse to mend it.
That startled me. That doesn't sound like a very Alka Alon way of handling things.
Did you not just say I was unique? A Terra Alon lord? She countered. A race without tradition? Perhaps it is my Humani heart that speaks. If my people give me their loyalty, I have no qualms about spending it to defend my dignity.
You make a compelling argument, my lady, I agreed. But if you wish to maintain the Humani hearts of the Terra Alon, I would encourage you to celebrate their feats in human style.
My race understands flattery, Minilin, she chuckled.
I have already planned a gathering to weep for the dead and celebrate the living. I will take the opportunity to laud the brave as well.
Presents, I advised.
Give them presents. As tokens of your gratitude. Praise them. Tell them how big and strong they are, and they'll follow you.
So I have seen,
she smirked. Sire Rife is a generous man, and since his rise in station and fortune, he seems to have acquired quite a following. I have no doubt. These hills are filled with errants who seek a man worthy of their loyalty. Encourage that. Be just as magnanimous with them as you are with your own folk, and you will win their loyalty as well.
So, what now?
She asked, folding her hands in her lap. We have raided the foe and dealt him a grievous blow, yet he stands stronger now than when we struck, she pointed out. That will be for the council to decide, I pointed out. Officially, this was just a reconnaissance in force mission that just got out of hand. But we must report both your father's fall and the intelligence we've gathered to them. Onranyan has set a meeting of the full council at midsummer. Once they know all the details, then they will decide the course of action.
And you are willing to meekly submit to their decisions? She asked.
Oh, hells no, I chuckled. I'll likely go do something stupid and brave if I don't like what they say. But they must plot the course first. I can't very well rebel until I have something to rebel against.
And your own kingdom? She asked.
I may be the Lady of Hosendor now, but I remain an emissary to humanity. What consequences will fall on you from this raid? Actually, it's been a boon at this point, for me and the Magi. But I am keeping a firm watch on the politics of Castel Shah. Our best hope lies in a strong, well-organized state. For all his personal issues, Rad has been doing a good job of that, particularly by getting the government out of Castabriel proper. I'll let you know if I think their faith in our alliance is fading. She shook her head.
It never ceases to amaze me how quickly things change for you,
she marveled. Alliances among the great houses of the Alka Alon endure for centuries, even temporary alliances. With you, Humani, we're lucky to persist for a decade. It's almost not worth the trouble. Which is why I'm building strong institutions, I reminded her. That is how humanity persists in maintaining its pledges. Men may come and go, but institutions can endure, if they are well wrought and well tended.
So you do,
she nodded. You have far more foresight than most of your race.
No offense.
None taken,
I chuckled, rising. There is one other matter I'd like to discuss. Your father's killer, Maisinamana.
What of her?
Fallowen asked sharply. I have her stashed away in a cell in my mountain at the moment, magically blinded and bound by chains of her own design and Dradrian manufacture. But I fear keeping her there. Could I impose on you to build a suitable prison for her? She doesn't eat much, I reminded her. She's undead.
You want me to become the jailer of my father's killer?
She asked, her pretty eyes wide in disbelief. I need a secure place to keep her. I can't kill her. She'd just return to Korbal then. I could just stuff her into a hoxter and forget about her. But I need her interrogated by someone motivated and trustworthy, and kept by someone with an interest in keeping her secure.
I would be able to question her.
To your human heart's content, I assured her.
I shall have a place prepared at once,
she agreed, and I am very much looking forward to meeting the woman who has caused me such grief. Now I must return to Hosendor and prepare for the Chepstow Fair, she sighed, when I will be gawked at and prodded by my new Humani noble peers, she said, her eyes narrowing at the word. I understand my lord husband wishes to show off his new bride, but the society of women in the Riverlands seems obsessed with gossip and inquiries into our personal lives, she said, troubled.
It is very disturbing.
Welcome to human femininity, I laughed. Perhaps our greatest weapon. I was riding back across the bridge that afternoon when I was overtaken by another rider. That isn't as hard as it sounds. While most bridges in the Riverlands were small, narrow affairs, usually barely large enough to permit a single horse or narrow-gauged cart, I had purposefully instructed Master Guri to design the Sevendor Bridge across our gigantic moat to be wide enough to permit two carts to pass each other without entangling. He'd spaced the risers accordingly, and had filled in the surface with a thick layer of mage-hardened wood. The bridgehead on the Hosendor side was still barely developed, with a single shack for the tollmen and the foundation of a future inn nearby. Toward the centre were the piers that would eventually guard the entire bridge and support a three-story fortress that would control the massive drawbridge. Additionally, there were platforms that would eventually house a few small businesses or permit folks to fish. Master Olmeg had not yet stocked the growing lake, but he was scheduled to do so before midsummer. The horseman proved to be my very own assistant castellan, Sir Festaren, returning from a trip to visit his parents. He was garbed in travelling armour, as any Riverlord knight would be, and he rode a fine gelding, not a warhorse.
"What think you of your new bridge, Excellency?" he asked, after we exchanged pleasantries.
"I like it," I assured him. "Hopefully it will distract from the missing mountain it replaced." "Was there any trouble while we were deployed?" I asked. Sire Kay was still recovering at his home in Carguenion, so Sir Festaren had been in charge.
"None to speak of. It's been blessedly quiet," he reported, as we rode side by side. "My father says that this is the most peaceful the Bontal has been in generations. His estates are prosperous, his peasants are happy, and commerce in the markets abound."
"Good to hear," I sighed sincerely. Keeping my vassals happy was always a priority. When push came to shove, they were my military force. "No stirrings from East Flaria?"
"Just Flaria now," Festaren chuckled. "Nay, my lord, Baron Fulric is reluctant to test his fortunes against the mighty spellmonger, though there are many who would induce him to do just that," he added suspiciously.
"Oh, really?" I asked, intrigued.
"Who?" "People who may have once worn checkered cloaks," he answered, "but Fulric wants none of it. He's turned away all who would tempt him into war with you or your allies."
"Nor do I covet new lands to manage," I pointed out. "If he is willing to maintain the peace, I certainly am."
"'Tis best to keep good relations, particularly ahead of the Riverlords League meeting," he agreed, "if we wish his support for Arathaniel."
"Arathaniel wants to be Count of Burin," I asked, startled.
"Old Count Mesterel wishes to retire," Festaren reported. "He announced his intention at Yule. While he has daughters married to good lords, none have the stature or reputation the office demands. The League will choose the new count after the harvest. Baron Arathaniel feels he has sufficient reputation after the war against Sashtalia, and should he prevail and rise his station,
He has two sons running two baronies to elevate his stature. He has a strong case, Verstalen said, hopefully.
Am I supposed to attend this meeting? I asked.
Peasants often assume that the feudal government is as straightforward as manorial government, but the opposite is true. It is a moot open to all river lords in the county, he affirmed. By tradition, the league selects the house to hold the title, but also by tradition, House Lensley is favoured to take it.
Are there other contenders? I asked, intrigued.
Oh, yes, there usually are, he agreed.
I've never been to a moot of the league before, but my father assures me that there are usually a score or more of contenders at the start.
Most lose favour quickly, leaving only a few from the established houses. The final victor of the vote is presented to His Grace for affirmation, purely a formality.
He paused a moment and gave me a searching look. There are those who whisper that you should seek the office, he proposed. You have gained the admiration of many in the Vales, even among the Sashtali who fought against you.
Me? Count, I snorted. I've already got about 6 jobs. Why do I need a 7th? Prestige? Position? Glory? He suggested.
Prestige is a fickle bitch you can't hunt, I observed, and not one that I seek. As far as position, I am already a member of the royal court, and am too much a soldier to invest in glory.
Nay, let Arathaniel take the prize if he wishes it. He has my blessing and support, I added, knowing that the word would travel quickly to Arathaniel's ears.
Well, not a spy. Sir Festaren had many friends among his fellow riverlords, the Sindari Knights of Chepstow Castle. I did not discourage the relationships. Such casual channels of communication were as important as actual spies in the world of feudal politics.
His Excellency will be happy to hear that, I have no doubt.
Festaren agreed, as we came to the 6 massive piers the Karshak had built to support the future bridge tower, and stopped to enjoy the view.
Excellency, he said after a moment's quiet contemplation, there is another matter I wished to discuss with you,
he said, in an entirely different tone. My heart sank. I could guess the topic. Go on, I said, not taking my eyes from the pretty water. In the sun, at this angle, the entire lake seemed to glow as the white stone under the water reflected the light. I wondered what it would look like if it had a scattering of mage lights that activated at dusk.
My lord, I have enjoyed the acquaintance of Lady Lenadara since before she was ennobled, he reminded me. Indeed, I have developed a growing affection toward her, and feel that it is, in part, returned. Perhaps you have noted this? He asked, suddenly sounding like an insecure teenaged boy, not the soldier I entrusted with the management of my castle.
I have noticed her friendship with you. I nodded. I've seen you dance together.
Then you understand how the affection I bear has blossomed into love, he professed. I am at an age where any man of station and rank would consider taking a wife and starting a family, and I find myself considering Lady Lenadara more and more suited to that end.
It was hardly an ode to Ishii, but the boy was trying. Do you know? I asked.
Indeed, he said with growing confidence. In fact, the purpose of my visit home was to propose the idea to my sire and dame, and they both favoured it. They have developed their own affection for her, and see it as a means of further binding the alliance between Horsley and Sevendor through matrimony.
That's well considered, I offered, still watching the water and the ducks.
We had ducks now? I intend now to put the question to her father. If he is agreeable, I would like to ask for her hand.
Have you discussed this with Dara yet? I inquired.
Nay, not explicitly, Festaren admitted. Hence my approaching her master. She is yet your apprentice, as well as your vassal. She cannot enter into any agreement without your permission.
Perhaps you should discuss it with Dara before you ask everyone else, I suggested, unless you think she would object.
He looked troubled. I do not think she would, yet I am unsure. She seems distraught since the holy visitation, since Gareth left.
You think her heart is confused by that?
I don't know, he complained, almost whining. Since Frightful Nested, she's been moody as Trig's moon. She says one thing, yet does another. Then Gareth, he professed his love, and she insisted on his friendship. When he would not accept the one without the other and left, she stopped talking.
I've heard her talk, I pointed out.
She's stopped talking to me,
he corrected,
about anything of consequence, as if I bear some part in his departure. And since she's returned from Olam Saheri, she's been positively morbid, he complained.
She lost men under her command, I reminded him, and birds she's raised from the egg.
Give her an opportunity to grieve before you suggest she change her life around, I suggested gently. I yield to your counsel, Excellency, he sighed. That is wisdom. Yet I must ask if the thought of such a union is pleasing to you,
he continued quietly.
If it is mutually agreeable, nothing would make me happier than to see you wed, in theory. But she is still a maiden, and one with great responsibilities. While I appreciate your enthusiasm, I caution your approach. Give her time, and invest in yourself.
How, my lord?
You are a Riverlord knight, I reminded him, one with good expectation and excellent reputation. You've proven yourself in battle. You've demonstrated your capability as an administrator, and you have performed your chivalric duties to the satisfaction of no less than Sire Kay himself.
Thank you, Excellency.
It wasn't a compliment. I continued, not really. I was stating objective facts, but that does not mean you should be content to rest upon them. Let me ask you, my young lord, what have you done to earn Dara's affection?
Why, I have been a steadfast friend to her, my lord, and have sought her favour at every turn.
To the amusement of my entire court, I agreed. Yet, while your service to Sevendor has been valiant, Dara associates with dragonslayers, mage lords, and warriors of renown. She just battled against Corbal the Necromancer in his own yard. While she bears you affection, what have you done to earn her admiration?
I keep the castle accounts, he pointed out lamely. I oversee the, yes, my lord, I think I see what you are saying. I suppose that knowing the volume of this lake to the pint, or the distance from here to your hall to the inch, is hardly worthy. At most, it is a curiosity, he said, frowning.
Yet your potential is endless, I pointed out, nor is it bounded by your sport talent. Sir Rife has not a jot of Regira, yet he won his bride by brave deeds and furious action.
You make a good point, my lord,
he agreed reluctantly, and such deeds are unlikely to come to Sevendor's door.
Perhaps Tyndall is correct. I do need to perform some errantry before I consider such a commitment. Yet I have duties.
I have many men who can fill your position temporarily, I suggested. Indeed, it would be helpful to give them the experience. Sir Onsil has several knights who have volunteered for duty at Sevendor Castle in preparation for greater service.
Then where would I go?
He asked, concerned. West, I suggested. To Gilmora, perhaps. Though we struck a serious blow to our foes, we've also bestirred a beehive. There will be reprisals and opportunities for valor. Maidens to be rescued, trolls to be fought, that sort of thing. Duke Anguin is to take possession of two of the vacant baronies which suffered so poorly during the invasion. He will have need of good men to help him reclaim them from the chaos.
That would be a worthy endeavour, he said hesitantly.
Or you can travel to the Wilderlands and join against the Givani who will swarm across the land in vengeance this summer, I suggested. There, the men of the Al-Shari Third Commando and the Iron Band will cross swords with the goblins, keeping them from crossing the river and retaking their slaves. If you seek glory, it will be there in blood-filled buckets.
That, too, would be a worthy enterprise,
he agreed, with more enthusiasm. Or, I continued, you can enlist in his grace's relief expedition. I hear that he's assembling a force at the coast to reinforce his landing in an ultramar. Assuming he wasn't killed during the naval battle, I added, we still have no word. But, assuming His Grace has made landfall, he's ordered a squadron of ships to bring an additional 10,000 men to reinforce his position. They will have to brave the Al-Shari rebel fleet, land at one of the most inhospitable lands in the Five Duchies, and fight their way through hostile territory to even get to their objective, I pointed out. But those who survive will be certain to be under His Grace's eye.
Should he survive?
I added.
I do not know how I would fare at sea, he admitted, but that does seem like an adventure.
My point is, Vestaren, this world is full of opportunities for heroism and chivalry, if you are willing to take the risk. But be warned,
I saw plenty of rotting corpses of knights your age on the jungle trails of Faris, who took those opportunities.
I do not fear death, my lord,
he said stiffly. It's not death you should be concerned with. It's ignominy, I counseled. As much as it galls me to say it, Tyndall is correct. If you want to win Dara's heart, then try being absent from her life and allowing longing to accumulate, and invest in your own worthiness, I added. You are a fine young man, but we live in an age in dire need of heroes. Take those talents out into the world and test your mettle. Cross swords with men who mean to kill you. Seek your fortune and compound what fame you may find, somewhere outside of the tournament lists, I added.
I am not so skilled at the jousts that I could make a living that way,
he admitted. Oh, you would do all right on the minor circuits. But you are better than that, Fastaran. I have no objection to you wedding Dara, should she desire it, but I would question you pressing your suit until you had some acclaim and stature you acquired in your own name. He looked out on the lake thoughtfully.
I think you are right, Excellency, though it pains me to leave such a beautiful place. I know there is a lot of the world I've yet to see. I will prepare for a few days. Consider my alternatives, and then slip away quietly,
he decided as we continued across the bridge.
I will, of course, advise you of my direction, he added.
That would be appreciated, I nodded, and I will prepare an adequate replacement for you as Assistant Castellan. I have every confidence you will discover a worthy quest for your errantry.
And I just bought you about 6 months for you to make up your mind about what you want, Dara,
I added to myself.
You're welcome.
Chapter 54 Three Holes in Vanador. My maid, Lavender, woke me up in the dead of night, her eyes wide with worry.
Master,
the Talalon servant said anxiously,
a messenger has come. It will not wait until morning,
she assured me. She didn't bother apologizing for waking me, as she knew I would want to be woken. Since young Daisy had left to tend to her litter last year, Lavender had taken over responsibilities for my chambers. She was much older than Daisy, and less prone to making poor judgments about when to wake me. I untangled myself from both children. Minalian had flopped across my chest at some point in the night, and Almina was curled up like a kitten next to me, a kitten with sharp, pointy elbows. While Lavender covered them up, I threw on a robe and stumbled down the stairs. Lyko Vanaran was waiting for me, to my surprise. My court wizard was still dressed, and I had no doubt that he was up late. Rumor had it that he only slept 4 hours a night.
Sorry to wake you, but I thought you should hear, he began, taking a seat at the permanent table in front of the fireplace.
I got word from a contact of mine in Faris. Tavard's fleet was attacked and decimated, with more than 40 ships sunk or captured, but by some quirk of fate he made landfall at Maiden's Pool with almost 50 ships and about 2,000 men. Enough to take the port.
The idiot made it,
I asked, startled.
He made it to Maiden's Pool,
Lyko corrected. That is no amazing feat. Maiden's Pool is a squalid little fishing village with a couple of temples in it. Basic defenses. It doesn't need more. It's 50 miles over miserable terrain to the next town of any significance. That one is in a swamp, and it doesn't lead to anywhere more exciting. If Tavard is going to get more than 1 foot on shore, he'll have to cross the Arangalan Peninsula and lay siege to a real town on the interior of the bay. The least of those is enough to hold out against the force he has now.
I'm just impressed the idiot made it, I repeated. I didn't think he'd get past the Armada.
When you're willing to sacrifice half your fleet to get your other half ashore, you might win sometimes, Lyko agreed. But I think you and I both know that it's a piss-poor strategy.
Oh, certainly, I nodded. I wasn't arguing in favor of it.
Those poor mariners and mercenaries will be paying for it with their lives now, either at sea or at the auction block in an ultramar. But I'll admit, I didn't think he'd make it that far.
I thought you should know, the Wenchari war mage nodded. The problem is, he commandeered most of the patrol fleet for the port when he made his daring run on an ultramar. The ships responsible for guarding Faris from, say, a massive rebel armada, he said angrily, and not just the ships. He took about half of the garrison, too. I swear, too, with a shipwrecker, that if he loses Faris after what we went through to capture it and keep it,
I feel the same way, I agreed. Let's hope no one noticed.
I thanked the wizard for the timely news, and showed him to the door before I headed back up to my chamber. I was on the third step when I was suddenly hailed, mind to mind.
Menelan, my kettle has tipped,
Pentandra said excitedly.
What?
I asked, confused. I was still thinking about troop deployments and naval battles.
My water broke,
she said, as if I were an idiot. It made an awful mess, and I started to have contractions.
Real ones this time, she insisted. I'm going to have babies.
That's exciting, Pen, I agreed.
Exciting? I'm bloody terrified.
As soon as I told Arborn he turned into an idiot boy, we sent for the midwife already, but it's started. I thought you might want to be here, she added. I knew Pentandra well enough to know that was her way of asking me to come without actually asking me.
Of course,
I agreed. Let me wake up a bit, pack some things, and I'll come through your waystone.
Hurry,
she pleaded.
I don't want you to miss it.
With three babies to go through, I didn't think I needed to hurry much. I didn't know a lot about labor and delivery, but I recalled what a slow process it usually was. A slow, painful, miserable process that turns otherwise pleasant women into raging beasts with its pain and suffering. Lavender, I announced, I need you to pack me a bag. I'm going to the Wilderlands for a few days. I came through the ways to the sound of Pentandra cursing, and I don't mean an off-the-cuff Ishi's tits, but a long and well-constructed string of invective that would make a veteran mariner blush.
Sorry,
she offered a moment later as she overcame the contraction.
Welcome to Vanador. Sorry about the mess,
she said, leaning her sweaty head back. She was being attended by a brace of nuns, midwives of Trig, and her mother. I considered sending back to Sevendor for additional help, but thought better of it. This was Pentandra's show. I was merely a spectator. Arborn was also nearby, looking as stricken with worry as I'd ever seen a man. I recognized the look. A man used to employing action to meet his challenges, being forced to patiently stand by as he helplessly watched the woman he loved suffer and dice with death.
How long has it been?
I asked.
Since this torture session started,
she said, as a nun wiped her brow.
3 hours now. 3 bloody hours of pain every 10 minutes.
There are spells, I suggested.
You don't think I'm employing them?
She asked incredulously. There's a limit to what magic can do, Min. This is going to hurt no matter what happens.
She's doing well,
Arborn said faintly. She breathes through the pain and doesn't fight the process.
Min,
Pentandra asked, mind to mind,
why don't you get Arborn out of here? There's a tiny little tavern at the end of the road. Take him there and calm him down. I'm never going to get through this if I have to worry about him, too.
I'll take care of him, Penny, I assured, recalling how Sire Kay had done me the same service when my children were born.
It would be my pleasure.
Arborn, let me examine Pentandra and then let's get some air, I suggested.
That wasn't part of the deal,
she whispered at me as I summoned insight to my hand. While not a medical baculus, the paraclete within was more than adequate for the basic scrying I needed to do. All three babies were head down, and there didn't seem to be any issue with their placement or where their umbilicals were. Their heartbeats were strong. I detected no sign of sepsis. But damn, it was crowded in there.
She's doing fine,
I assured Arborn in my most confident voice. Well enough that she can spare you for a few moments.
Spare me?
Arborn asked, confused.
She needs me.
Sure she does, I said soothingly, but she needs you at your best, and right now you look like a man whose dog died this morning. Come with me, I commanded.
Thank you,
Pentandra mouthed as she sipped water from a silver cup the nun held to her lips. I took Arborn outside the croft and into the early morning darkness. It was chilly. Up here in the northern wilderlands, far colder than Sevendor had been. I made my way down the steps and then stopped in confusion.
Arborn,
I said hesitantly, someone went and built a road through here.
I know,
he agreed as he followed. Carmella began construction on some parts of the settlement last year, he reminded me.
She's got the entire city planned out. She started with the main road here, he indicated, taking a right onto the flagged surface with the tidy gutter down the middle. It curves around the north side here and to the overhang. That's where the town proper will be.
That's fairly ambitious, isn't it?
I asked. There seems to be plenty of room right around this croft.
This will be Wizard's Way someday, he answered with a smirk. The residents of the town's leading arcane aristocracy, including my wife. The commercial area will be in the overhang, in the town, where it's protected.
So where is this tavern she told me of?
Just a walk away, he grunted. It's late, but the keeper will serve us.
We can serve ourselves at need, I agreed. I just thought you might need some air.
He nodded.
Dear gods, is it like this every time a woman gives birth?
They call it labor for a reason, I agreed.
Then it's a wonder we reproduce at all, he said, shaking his head.
That's why Ishii makes conception so much fun, I reasoned, to keep us doing it.
But take heart, Pentandra is no fresh-faced maiden afraid of birth. She's a mature woman of 25, well able to contend with the pain and stress. In truth, she's more worried about you.
About me?
He asked, confused. I'm in no danger. But she is. And worrying about you is not what she needs right now, I said, as I summoned a mage light to keep us from stumbling. I saw in its light the silhouettes of the small cottages and crofts that had been built along the road. While humble, there were a lot of them, far more than I expected.
Who in three hells built all these homes? Who lives here?
I demanded.
The quarry lies but a few miles to the south,
Arborne reported. Carmella brought in over 100 workers for it, and they had to live somewhere, and then 100 more to cook and fashion for them. There are a few carpenters, a smith, masons, and stonecutters here now.
I thought Carmella was using bricking wands.
She is, for the structural portions, he agreed, relieved to be talking about anything else than his wife's mortality. But there is a lot of ornamental and specialty work to be done, too. There are over 500 souls in Vanador now, he said proudly. There is even an estate of sorts. Not yet enough to feed everyone, but a start.
As we crossed beyond the looming shape of the anvil to our right, I glimpsed a light in the distance. Several lights, I realized. Off to the west there were a score or more of tiny lights. Campfires.
Those are the escaped slaves, Arborne explained when I asked. We brought 30,000 of them to the plain below. They have tarpaulins and tents for now. I doubt that there is a Wilderlord with a tournament pavilion left in Alshar. The others are farther south in other camps.
That is a lot of people, I said.
More than lived in Sevendor by far.
How are they faring?
They are free from the Gavanni, he pointed out. Their happiness is relative. Yet there are many who seek to repatriate. A large number of Gilmorans who were taken in the invasion. Others have given up hope of returning home and are just looking for some sort of life.
How are you feeding them?
Your friend Bannermore, Arborne chuckled as we approached the tavern. It was hardly tiny, but then Pentandra doesn't hang out at a lot of taverns. He's bringing about a ton of wheat and another of rice every week. That and produce, purchased from the few surviving farms and from the markets of Verone, have kept every belly full, or at least not empty. We have fields planned for next year, and work gangs clearing them of stones, but we won't be able to plough until midsummer at the earliest. Perhaps a crop of winter wheat.
It sounds as if you have labor enough, I agreed. What about security?
I have a unit of the Third Commander stationed at the entrance of the Vale, and outposts of Kasari along the western range. The former slaves themselves have patrols around their camp. Enough of them have been soldiers to keep order.
I suppose it solves the labor problem, I agreed. What about the artisans?
We've given what attention we can to those with useful skills. Speak to Master Arni tomorrow and he will tell you more. But we've set up 2 barbers so far and a shoemaker in the overhang. There is a small tannery on the river nearby. The lumber yard employs many, and the smith now has 3 apprentices whose service was interrupted by slavery. We've ordered some equipment from Bannermore. Once it arrives, we can put together a millwork, he said proudly. Then he banged on the stout wooden door of the tavern. Kidnath, awake, he demanded.
Your lord needs a drink.
His lord? Anguin made me lord. He shrugged. He gave me the estate nearest to the Kasari lands for my own. Kidnerth is from there. This is his shop, the Flickering Flame. Indeed, there was a small sign that showed a painting of a cozy little fire in a fireplace. Kidnerth opened the door, welcomed Arborn, whom he recognized at once, and when he heard that Lady Pentandra was in labor, he bustled about the place. In moments, he put a bottle of spirits and a plate of biscuits on the board while he stirred the fire into life.
Relax, I urged him as I dug out my pipe. This will be fine. By morning you may be the proud papa of three daughters, I pointed out. You're doomed.
The spirits were apple, distilled from the hard cider that was so common in the Wilderlands. It tasted like concentrated autumn, leaves swirling on my tongue, and burned all the way down my gullet. The smoke helped cool the flames, and I started to relax myself into a warm, apple-scented haze.
I fought for an entire day at Olam Saheri,
the dark-eyed ranger said, as he sipped his spirits.
I faced creatures that should never have been made. Dead men with glowing eyes. Yet I'd wish myself back there again rather than endure this helplessness.
Yet you must, I advised. Let the birthing chamber do its work.
I'm here, I reminded him. If there are issues, Pentandra has the best possible resources. I can have Master Ikarod or one of his journeymen here within the hour if there is trouble.
Hells, at need I can appeal to Trigg herself. She's already blessed this pregnancy, I reminded him.
I know, the big man grumbled. None of that makes any difference in my heart.
That I can understand, I sighed sympathetically. To compound your anxiety, let me be the first to tell you that this is but the beginning of your journey into terror. The fear you feel now, it is nothing compared to the fear you'll face the first dawn you have three daughters to concern yourself with. That day, my friend, you will begin to know the meaning of terror.
You really aren't making me feel better,
Arborn accused me sullenly. There's nothing that can make you feel better, I offered.
Well, there's one thing.
What?
He asked.
It's a bit of magic. Not to take away your anxiety exactly, but...
What is it? He demanded. What can I do?
Drink that, I said, pouring his glass to the rim, quickly. And then let me make an inquiry. It took a few moments, reaching out to different people mind to mind, but I eventually got someone, Banimal, who delegated it to one of his staff, who could procure what I needed, and sent it through a huckster. 20 minutes and three drinks of spirits later, we were ready.
Come with me,
I said mysteriously as I tapped out my pipe and put it away. Kidnerth, boil some water. We'll want tea and biscuits when we're done, and porridge.
Where are we going?
Arborn asked, confused, as I led him outside and around the back of the tavern.
Right about here will do, I decided. I cast a mage light to illuminate the place.
The first faint glow of dawn was arising along the horizon in the east, but it was still as dark as a miner's butt. When my father heard that I was having a girl, he gave me some advice, I said, stripping off my mantle. As the father of five daughters himself, he was full of sage wisdom on the subject of raising girls.
Are they any different than raising boys?
Worlds apart, I nodded.